Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Events in Ferguson, Baltimore, Charleston, and elsewhere have put our policing and sentencing guidelines into question. What really motivates the mindsets in our criminal justice system, be they police officers, prosecutors, judges, jurors, witnesses, trial experts, and consultants? Well, that's the topic taken up in Adam Benferrato's new book entitled Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice. He's an associate professor of law at Drexel University. And Professor, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
It's a pleasure.
Now, of course, idealistically, Lady Justice is blind. Realistically, you contend that that blind spot exists in all of us in terms of our lack of awareness about how we make all sorts of decisions, including those around culpability.
Exactly. So I think for really the entirety of our criminal justice system, for all of the decades and centuries it's been around, we have sort of assumed that we are people that we are not, that we are rational people who are able to see within ourselves and recognize what we believe to be true, to understand when we are biased and when we're not, and to control for those factors. And I think what the latest evidence from psychology and neuroscience suggests is that a lot of our legal system is based on myths about human behavior.
And that starts from Supreme Court justices on down. Justice Roberts, when he was being interrogated about his abilities to serve, said, well, I see this more like umpiring a baseball game, calling the balls and strikes rather than making decisions based on what he brought to the decision-making process.
And I think that's where the danger lies. They're activist judges and umpire judges. I'm an umpire judge. That suggests that judicial bias is subject to introspection and control. But what we know from the research from psychology is that all judges are susceptible to numerous biases. And a lot of these biases operate beyond people's conscious awareness. So that might be an implicit racial bias, which leads a judge to set higher bails for African Americans than for whites. That might be something as crazy as a time of day effect. We know with research that was done with respect to Israeli parole boards that the time of day can influence whether someone is granted parole. That's not supposed to be the way our system works. And so I think we need to acknowledge the truth about what's moving our legal actors.
What does that say about our jury system?
I worry about our jury system a little bit. I think that our jurors actually work very hard. I think that it is a myth that people who serve on juries don't care, that they're stupid. I think the truth, though, is that they're human. And so they're subject to numerous biases, just like judges and police officers.
And the attorneys know that in the course of the voir dire process.
They do. And so when the voir dire process was developed, the whole idea was to allow lawyers an opportunity to get rid of bias within the jury pool. And what it's turned into is figuring out a way to bias the jury pool in your favor. And that's sort of, I think, a natural development that results from our adversarial system.
You describe this system as essentially the blame game, pointing fingers at who's culpable rather than solving the whole issue of trying to limit and reduce crime.
So we talk a lot about, and when I, you know, I teach criminal law and ask my students, you know, what's the purpose of sending someone to prison? The stories that we tell about why we do that have a lot to do with what we might consider consequentialist concerns. Well, we need to deter other would-be offenders. We need to incapacitate dangerous people. When we actually look at the psychology of what's driving our motivations for punishment, oftentimes it has a lot more to do with delivering payback. And I think that that's deeply problematic. And I think if we are to achieve a just system, we ought to look at a different model, one not based around assigning blame, but rather one based around a disease model in which we try to rehabilitate the person who has committed the crime, where we try to restore the community, the victim, and where we look to the best possible ways to prevent similar actions from occurring in the future.
And with that, your book does look in part to Norway, Germany, the Netherlands.
Well, it's really interesting. For a very long time, Europe and the whole world looked to the United States. They looked to Eastern State Penitentiary as a model.
That word, penitence.
Exactly. So when Charles Dickens was visiting the United States in the 19th century, he said, you know, the things that I'm most looking forward to visiting are Niagara Falls and Eastern State. That's what I want to see. And I think that the tables have really turned. We need to look now to Northern Europe and the ways that they are thinking about their correctional systems. And the focus in countries like the Netherlands, Germany, Norway is really focused on rehabilitation. It's about repairing harms. It's about looking forward to how can we best ensure that this person becomes a successful member of society. We've tried mass incarceration. We've tried solitary confinement, supermax prisons. And all that's done is leave us with a lot less money for all of the other important things that we need to spend money on in society.
And so you advocate instead something akin to a public health model.
Absolutely. So I think that we really need to look at sort of how medicine has developed over time to treat, you know, outbreaks of disease. I think a disease model with respect to crime would leave us in a much better position as a society. I think it would allow us to refocus rather than on trying to treat problems after they've already occurred to preventing them. And I genuinely believe that in the future, our tools of criminal justice will not be trials and prisons. They will be elementary schools, better schools. They will be better mental health care facilities. They will be community improvement, neighborhood improvement projects. That's what the world of criminal justice is going to look like in 100, 200 years.
So speak of the value of science and technology advances that certainly weren't available in the days of Eastern State, be they body cameras or DNA forensics.
I'm very excited about new developments and the willingness of police departments and prisons to try new ways of doing things. But I think we always have to be cautious with respect to technology. So with respect to body cameras and squad car cameras, we've seen in the last few months the benefits that can come from those technologies. The thing that I worry about is how we use that technology. And there's really interesting research on something called camera perspective
body
bias.
Camera is point of view.
Exactly. And I think it's not just psychologists who understand this. It's students of film understand this. It really matters whether you have the camera from behind and offering the perspective of the police officer or from, say, the perspective of the person being interrogated in experiments. That simple change of the frame actually alters how people see that particular interrogation. Is it coerced? Well, it looks a lot more coerced if we're seeing the perspective offered through the eyes of the suspect.
DNA evidence sounds foolproof, but even that's subject to some element of bias.
The problem with DNA testing is we consider it absolutely objective. We think, you know, fingerprint analysis, DNA analysis, these things are cut and dried. But unfortunately, they're subject to confirmation bias. So when a lab technician is aware that this particular sample comes from someone who already confessed or perhaps was identified by an eyewitness, they're more likely to find that to be a match. That's really scary, and that's one of the reasons in the book that I advocate for blind testing. We do the same thing in medicine. We ought to do it with respect to our lab technicians also.
New Jersey, among states in the vanguard regarding that public health model in terms of Governor Chris Christie's call to look at drug-related crimes and addiction as a disease.
That's another exciting development, are what are called problem-solving courts. The idea is all of us, prosecutors, defense attorneys, judges, let's all work together to figure out a path forward that actually works. You've done something wrong. You've hurt society. You've hurt those around you. You've hurt the victim. What can we do to ensure that this doesn't happen again? One of the things that works a lot better is understanding most people who have drug abuse problems are going to relapse. So a system that says any relapse at all, you're going away for 5 years. That's not going to work. It's not going to work for the person, and it doesn't work for judges because judges, when they come to apply that parole violation, they don't want to apply it. So the person doesn't ever get the help that they need. So I think New Jersey and other states that are trying these different models really at the forefront, and I'm excited to see where things lead.
On the other hand, though, speak to systemic inertia in our criminal system. One example you cite is the notion of stare decisis that prevents moving ahead at a rapid pace.
Well, it's very, very hard. I mean, I think that my criminal law students come in expecting law school to look a lot like medical school. They expect to sort of just take all of these rules which have been developed by people who are way smarter than them centuries ago and just memorize them and then go out in the world and apply them. And that's how you become a successful lawyer. And I try very hard to get them to think, wait a second, judges make mistakes. The people who wrote the Constitution may not have been able to foresee developments in our world, and they might have written a very different constitution if they had lived in 2015. I try to get them to understand, well, even if these people who came before us were more enlightened, they didn't have access to the same information and tools and abilities to change the system that we have now. But it's an uphill battle. I think a lot of times, you know, the fact that an opinion is in a case book, a lot of my students just want to take that as gospel. It's in a book. It's in a heavy book that I paid $200 for. So it must be correct. And I try to get them to think, well, judges are just humans. And people who lived in the 18th century are just humans, but they lack all of this scientific evidence that we have. It's very hard. I worked for a judge. I worked as a lawyer. And I know the inertia in our system. But one thing I also know is that the last several months have really changed the landscape in criminal justice. When I started writing this book, 5 years ago, I couldn't have foreseen all of the events in Ferguson and New York, everywhere. And I think that what has happened is the general public has reached a point where they have lost faith in the criminal justice system. They no longer believe that it delivers fairness. And I think that when you see all of the major presidential candidates on both sides developing criminal justice platforms, that's a sign that now is the time for reform.
Though aspects of your book go well beyond reform to what some would call revolution, discuss your notion of virtual trials replacing the kind we know about now.
One of my ideas for where I think our system is headed is directly controlling for bias by preventing biases from ever manifesting themselves. And if you think logically about what that would entail, well, if we know that people focus when they're trying to decide whether a witness is telling the truth on the attractiveness of that person, whether the person is averting their gaze, both things which have no relationship at all, whether someone is being deceitful or not. If people, when they're deciding how much to punish someone, are taking cues off of the color of a person's skin, well, one idea I think is let's not let them see those factors. And so what if we moved our courtrooms into virtual spaces? And the seeming constitutional problems with that, I think, are not insurmountable at all. I think that certainly we've already been making exceptions with respect to in-person testimony. And I think if we preserve the focus on the ability to, you know, cross-examine witnesses, the need for them to be directly in person in real time is less important.
Justice could potentially truly be blind.
But we have to make it that way. We can't just assume that it is naturally.
Professor, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
It was great. Thanks so much.
We've been speaking with Adam Benferrato. His new book is entitled Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice. He's an associate professor of law at Drexel University.